Welcome to the deep dive. Today we're tackling something that plays a surprisingly big role in your paycheck and, well, your overall security. Voluntary benefits. Think of it as your employer offering a sort of menu of options. They've done the legwork, you know, getting group rates, setting up an enrollment platform.
Right.
But you're in the driver's seat. You choose what fits your life, your budget.
Mm-hmm.
And we're talking about a lot more than just like extra life insurance these days.
Oh, definitely. It really stretches now. Things like help with student loans or even insurance for your pets.
Pets. Okay.
Exactly. And what's fascinating, I think, is how much this landscape has really transformed.
How so?
Well, over the past, say, two decades, voluntary benefits have shifted. They've gone from being just a few supplemental things to a really, really diverse toolkit.
A toolkit. I like that.
Yeah. So now you can find everything from supplemental health plans. You mentioned those gap fillers like accident, critical illness, hospital indemnity coverage.
Right. Helping with those high deductibles.
Precisely. To very specific life and disability policies. And then there's this whole other range of lifestyle benefits.
Lifestyle, like what?
Things like legal help, identity theft protection, support for maybe elder care responsibilities, even discount programs on everyday stuff.
Okay, so it really sounds like it's gone from, I don't know, a side dish to almost a key ingredient in the whole benefits package.
That's a great way to put it, yeah.
Why this big expansion, though? What's really driven this shift?
Well, what's really interesting here is how the workforce itself has evolved. And the economy, too, right? Mm. Employers are realizing that, you know, a one-size-fits-all benefits package just doesn't cut it anymore. People's needs are too diverse.
Makes sense.
So voluntary benefits offer a way to cater to all those individual needs, often without a huge direct cost hitting the company's bottom line immediately.
Ah, okay.
Plus, you know, economic shifts, rising healthcare costs,
mm-hmm.
that's made people, maybe you included, more aware of your own financial vulnerability. So there's more interest in these kinds of protections.
You mentioned earlier the landscape has kind of exploded. Can you give us a better sense of the scope now? What kind of options are we really talking about today?
Yeah, it's pretty comprehensive. Mm-hmm. So beyond the traditional extra life and disability insurance.
The basics.
The basics, okay. Exactly. The growth has been huge in supplemental health. Those accident, critical illness, hospital indemnity plans, they're increasingly popular.
Right.
Then you have more specialized life and disability coverages, maybe for specific situations.
Mm-hmm.
Legal services, ID theft protection, addressing very modern risks.
Definitely modern risks.
And then those lifestyle benefits we touched on, pet insurance is a big one. Student loan repayment help is emerging.
Student loans, yeah, that's huge for a lot of people.
It really is. And even things like emergency savings accounts facilitated through payroll, financial wellness tools.
Yeah.
And it shows the focus has broadened quite a lot. The overall well-being, really.
So it's not just about filling gaps in your main insurance anymore. It sounds like it's addressing a much wider set of potential risks, offering convenience too.
Precisely. Yes, modern voluntary benefits are designed to extend that core protection, definitely. But they also tackle these emerging risks you might face. They offer the convenience of payroll deduction, those group rates we mentioned. And ultimately, they really try to accommodate the very diverse needs of, well, today's workforce.
Okay. So the mission for us today for this deep dive is really to get to grips with how these benefits have grown, what they look like now, and crucially, why you, the listener, should maybe pay closer attention.
Exactly.
And we're drawing on the voluntarybenefitsoverview.pdf to kind of guide this conversation.
That's the plan. We want to unpack all this so you can understand the evolution, the current state, and hopefully feel a bit more empowered to make informed choices about what might be right for you.
Okay, so we've touched on the evolution. It wasn't always this broad, was it? When did we start seeing that shift from just nice to have extras to something more integral?
Yeah, it's fascinating because it really wasn't an overnight thing. Not at all. It's been a gradual transition, really over the last couple of decades.
Mm-hmm.
Initially, yeah, voluntary benefits were often seen as peripheral, just a little something extra on the side.
Right.
But as employee needs got more diverse and economic pressures, frankly, increased, employers started seeing them as a strategic way to enhance the total compensation package.
Ah, strategic. So not just adding cost, but adding value.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Adding perceived value, often without needing to hike up salaries across the board.
Oh.
And the sophistication of enrollment has also played a massive role.
How so? Yeah.
Well, we've moved from, you know, piles of paper forms.
Oh, I remember those.
Right. To really advanced decision support tools,
yeah,
personalized communications, mm-hmm, stuff that makes it genuinely easier for you to understand the options available.
And it's not just the sign-up process that's gotten fancier, right? The products themselves, you said, are more targeted now.
Absolutely. Carriers, the insurance companies, they're constantly innovating. They're offering increasingly specialized products.
Based on data.
Yeah, they're analyzing data, tailoring plans to specific industries, different employee demographics, very particular needs. You're seeing fewer sort of generic one-size-fits-all offerings, and more solutions designed for specific vulnerabilities.
Here's a question I bet a lot of listeners have. Who's actually using these benefits the most? Are there, like, trends in who's adopting them?
That's a great question. We're seeing the fastest growth in adoption among mid-size employers.
Mid-size. What range is that typically?
Think companies with around, say, 100 to maybe 999 employees.
Okay.
Certain industries also tend to have higher participation. Healthcare, education, manufacturing often show higher take-up rates.
Interesting.
And interestingly, the period after the COVID-19 pandemic really seemed to accelerate this growth pretty much across the board.
That makes sense. That heightened awareness of vulnerability you mentioned.
Definitely. That what-if scenario became very real for a lot of people, putting financial protection front and center.
Now, when we talk about who provides these benefits, it's not just one type of insurance company doing this, is it?
No, not at all. The provider landscape is actually quite diverse. You've got your specialized voluntary benefit carriers companies, where this is basically their main thing, like Aflac or Colonial Life.
Right, the names you see advertised.
Exactly. Then you have the big traditional health and life insurance carriers, MetLife, Prudential, Cigna, people like that, who also offer voluntary options as part of their broader portfolio.
Okay.
There's also what's called the carrier direct model, where smaller businesses might work straight with an insurance company rep.
Simpler for them, maybe?
Potentially. Then you have enrollment companies. They specialize just in the communication and the sign-up process.
Helping employees understand it all.
Precisely. And we're seeing the rise of these digital marketplace platforms, too.
Mm-hmm.
Online self-service environments offering a whole suite of benefits.
And these models aren't totally separate, are they? You said they're kind of blending.
Yeah, that's a key trend. They're increasingly overlapping and hybridizing. You might see a traditional carrier using an enrollment firm's platform, for example.
And I imagine technology has just been a massive enabler for all this expansion and diversification.
Absolutely massive. Technology has been fundamental. We now have integrated benefits administration platforms, Ben admin systems that handle everything. Eligibility, enrollment, ongoing admin, often all in one place.
Making it seamless.
Ideally, yeah. Then you've got decision support tools built in, helping you navigate the choices, understand what might fit your situation.
Like interactive guides.
Exactly. The enrollment experience itself is often digital now, mobile friendly. And behind the scenes, things like APIs, application programming interfaces, allow data to sync up between the employer, the carrier, the payroll system.
Connecting the dots.
Right. And the pandemic, again, just poured fuel on the fire for adopting these digital tools.
No kidding.
And alongside that, we've seen this sustained increase in interest in benefits supporting mental health, work-life balance, overall financial wellness.
Mm.
A lot driven by that economic uncertainty. These shifts, the tech and the benefit focus, they really seem to be sticking around.
So it's not just about offering more coverage options. It's about making them easier to understand, enroll in, manage, really integrating them into the whole employee experience.
Exactly right. It's moved way beyond just being a list of optional extras. It's become a much more strategic, integrated part of how companies think about their total rewards package for you, the employee.
Okay, so we've looked at it from the employer side, the market evolution. Now, let's bring it down to a personal level. Why should you, the listener, really care about understanding these voluntary options? What's actually in it for you?
Yeah, good question. From your perspective, these voluntary benefits offer some really significant advantages. First off, accessibility.
Accessibility.
Yeah, they provide access to protection that you might not otherwise be able to get, or that could be way more expensive if you tried to buy it on your own individually.
Because of the group rates.
Exactly. Group underwriting, often meaning less health screening, and those group rates. Plus, the convenience of payroll deduction.
Mm-hmm.
That makes managing the cost much simpler for a lot of people.
Yeah, that payroll deduction is key, isn't it? It's often a small amount taken out each paycheck, which can feel much easier to budget for than, say, a big annual or semi-annual bill.
Precisely. And secondly, these benefits can act as a really crucial financial safety net.
A safety net.
Yeah. They provide a layer of protection against specific financial risks, things that could really throw your finances off track. Unexpected medical bills, losing income if you get sick or hurt, facing legal costs, the nightmare of identity theft.
Things you hope won't happen, but might.
Exactly. They address those specific vulnerabilities.
Now, does the way these benefits are approached and offered differ much depending on where you work, like a huge corporation versus a small local business?
Oh, definitely. There are significant differences. Large employers, let's say 1,000 employees or more, they often have these highly integrated tech platforms we talked about.
The sophisticated systems.
Right. Bringing all benefits, core and voluntary, into one streamlined experience. They usually have the resources, HR teams, consultants, to design more customized programs.
Tailored to their workforce.
Yeah, and they tend to use data analytics pretty heavily to understand their workforce needs and shape their offerings. Their planning is usually more long-term focused.
But maybe more complex to roll out.
Sometimes, yeah. The sheer scale can make implementation tricky.
What about if you're working for a smaller company, say under 100 employees? What's the landscape like there?
For small businesses, the approach is often more, let's say, relationship-driven.
Meaning?
They might rely more heavily on a trusted relationship with an insurance broker or maybe a specific carrier representative. They typically have much leaner HR resources.
So simplicity is key.
Hugely important. Simplicity and ease of administration are paramount. While tech adoption is definitely growing in the small business space, it might not be as fully integrated. Many separate systems for different benefits. They're often trying to strike that balance, offering valuable benefits while keeping things manageable and, crucially, cost-effective.
And what about folks working in the public sector? Government jobs, schools, or for nonprofits? Are there different dynamics there?
Yes, absolutely. The public sector often involves more formal procurement processes. Mm-hmm. Think RFPs, requests for proposals, competitive bidding. It can be quite structured.
More bureaucracy, maybe?
Sometimes, yeah. There can also be political sensitivities. Maybe union negotiations are involved. They often have their own distinct administrative structures and sometimes constraints.
And the benefits themselves.
The value proposition might be slightly different. Maybe focusing on filling specific gaps in what are often already quite comprehensive public sector benefit packages. Mm. Participation can actually be quite high, but the implementation timelines might sometimes stretch out longer.
Okay. And nonprofits?
Nonprofits often bring their mission and values into the conversation. How do benefits align? They usually operate with tighter resource constraints, like small businesses.
Budget limitations.
Right. And they often have very diverse workforces, people with very different compensation levels. They might explore alternative funding options, maybe self-funding or joining captives. Voluntary benefits are often seen as a good way to enhance maybe more modest core benefits. But effectiveness really varies depending on the nonprofit's size, capacity, and where benefits rank in their priorities.
Wow. So it's really clear that understanding the specific context, the size, the industry, the nature of the organization is crucial for designing and offering relevant voluntary benefits.
Absolutely.
And today's workforce itself is just so diverse, isn't it?
Incredibly diverse. We're seeing this real spectrum of employees. You've got generational differences.
Right.
From the silent generation still working through boomers, Gen X, millennials, now Gen Z entering.
All with different priorities.
Exactly. Different financial priorities, different communication preferences, different expectations about benefits altogether. Family structures, too, are just incredibly varied now. It's way beyond the traditional nuclear family. Single parents, blended families, multi-generational households, people choosing not to have children.
The life looks different for everyone.
It really does. Then layer on the full range of financial situations, from people feeling quite vulnerable to those who are very secure. And health status varies widely too, impacting protection needs.
And cultural background, does that play a role?
It definitely can. Cultural diversity influences attitudes towards insurance, financial protection, even how people prefer to communicate about these topics. A one-size-fits-all approach is just increasingly ineffective. That's why we keep seeing this strong trend towards personalization and more flexible voluntary options.
Okay, so given all that diversity and just the sheer number of potential options we've talked about,
right.
how do you even begin to figure out which voluntary benefits are the right fit? Where do you start with that personal needs assessment?
That is the critical question, isn't it? It really starts with taking a close, honest look at your own financial situation. Where are your potential vulnerabilities?
Or what ifs?
Exactly. What are the what if scenarios that could really have a significant financial impact on you and your family? Think about your health, your income security, potential big unexpected expenses down the line.
Okay.
Then, of course, you have to consider your budget. What can you comfortably, realistically allocate to premiums each month or each paycheck?
Right. Affordability is huge.
Absolutely. But the challenge is, as we've kind of touched on, many people don't have a strong background in insurance. It can feel complex.
Yeah, overwhelming sometimes.
Right. It's genuinely difficult for many people to accurately assess these risks and quantify the potential financial impact. That's why clear, simple education and those user-friendly decision support tools provided during enrollment are just so incredibly important.
And it's not always just a cold, rational calculation either, is it? Mm. Our emotions, our past experiences, they must play a role in how we see risk and make these choices.
Oh, absolutely. Your individual perception of risk can be very different from the objective probabilities. It's often heavily influenced by personal health history, family experiences.
And if your parent had a specific illness.
Exactly. Or if you've had a major unexpected expense before. Your level of financial literacy also makes a huge difference.
Yeah.
How comfortable and confident you feel evaluating these sometimes complex options.
Hmm.
And the environment itself, the time pressure of open enrollment, how the information is presented, whether you get any personalized guidance, all that influences your choices. Even, you know, what your colleagues are choosing can sometimes sway decisions. Social influence is real.
Now, behind all of this, the employers making offers, employees making choices, the insurance carriers providing products, there's a whole network of other players involved in this voluntary benefits world, isn't there? It's like an ecosystem.
That's the perfect word for it. It really is a dynamic ecosystem. And it's constantly shifting. We're seeing this convergence among different types of carriers.
Oh, really?
Yeah, like traditional health insurers expanding into voluntary benefits, life insurers adding supplemental health options, specialized carriers broadening their portfolios. The lines are blurring.
Interesting.
Strategic partnerships are popping up everywhere. Companies combining strengths. Maybe one has great products, another has strong distribution or tech.
Makes sense, leveraging each other.
Exactly. Your traditional employee benefit brokers. They're increasingly focusing on voluntary benefits, seeing it as part of a holistic strategy for their clients.
Not just an add-on anymore.
Right. Enrollment firms, as we mentioned, specialize in communicating and enrolling these benefits. Third-party administrators, or TPAs, handle a lot of the back-end administrative functions like processing enrollments and managing premiums.
Nuts and bolts.
The crucial nuts and bolts. And looming over all of it is the regulatory landscape, state insurance departments, the Federal Department of Labor, the IRS. They all set rules that shape how this ecosystem operates.
So changes in one part can affect everyone else.
Absolutely. It's all interconnected. Successfully navigating this space, whether you're an employer, a broker, or even an employee making choices, requires understanding these different perspectives and the system-wide patterns.
Okay, let's maybe zoom in on some of these product categories themselves. Give people a better feel for the options. Life insurance offered as a voluntary benefit, what makes that different from maybe a policy you'd buy on your own?
Good place to start. Voluntary life insurance, often term life, sometimes permanent options too, is frequently a cornerstone of these programs. One common feature is composite rating.
Composite rating.
It simplifies pricing by using age bands, say ages 30, 39, pay one rate, 40, 49, pay another, instead of pricing based on your exact individual age each year.
Ah, so it averages the risk within an age group.
Exactly. This often makes it more affordable, especially for younger employees who might otherwise pay very low rates that creep up. Another key benefit is usually portability.
Portability meaning you can take it with you if you leave.
Generally, yes. You can usually continue the coverage, paying the premiums directly if you leave that employer, that's a huge plus. The success of these plans really hinges on educating employees about their actual life insurance needs and offering products that are easy to grasp and align with those needs.
Okay. And disability insurance, short-term and long-term, that's all about protecting your income if you can't work, right? What are some key things to look for in the voluntary versions?
Precisely. Income protection. Voluntary disability, or DI, can provide crucial coverage, either supplementing something your employer already provides or acting as the main coverage if they don't offer any base DI.
Right.
You'll often see different choices for the elimination period. That's the waiting period, how long you have to be disabled before benefits kick in.
Mm-hmm.
7 days, 30 days, 90 days.
Okay.
For short-term disability, STD, the definition of disability is often based on your inability to do your own job, at least initially. Long-term disability, LTD, might transition to an any occupation definition after a couple of years.
Ah, that's an important distinction.
It really is.
Yeah.
We're also seeing more comprehensive voluntary DI plans emerging. They might include higher benefit maximums, maybe enhancements for catastrophic disabilities, support for rehabilitation, even riders to help cover student loan payments if you become disabled. These are really critical for financial wellness.
Now, you mentioned supplemental health insurance as a fast-growing area. Can you break that down a bit more? What falls under that umbrella and why the surge?
Yeah, supplemental health is definitely a hot spot. It's really designed to help you manage those increasing out-of-pocket healthcare costs.
The cost insurance doesn't cover.
Exactly. As primary medical plans move towards higher deductibles, higher copays, more coinsurance, these plans step in. Like accident insurance, critical illness insurance, yeah. Hospital indemnity insurance.
Okay.
They work differently than major medicals. They typically pay a fixed cash benefit directly to you if you experience a covered health event, like a specific injury, a serious diagnosis, or a hospital stay.
Cash you can use for anything.
Generally, yes. Deductibles, copays, travel to appointments, childcare, lost wages, whatever you need. The range of covered events and conditions is expanding, and some plans even add things like telemedicine benefits or riders for injuries from organized sports. The rising cost of healthcare is the huge driver here. People feel those gaps more acutely.
Hey, let's talk critical illness insurance specifically. That pays a lump sum if you get diagnosed with something serious, like cancer or stroke. What are the key features there?
Yes, exactly. Lump sum cash payment upon diagnosis of a covered serious condition.
Yeah.
The key trigger is the diagnosis itself, usually not the treatment costs incurred.
So it's quick access to funds?
Potentially, yes.
Yeah.
Many plans now cover a broader list of conditions. Cancer, heart attack, stroke are common, but they might include things like kidney failure, major organ transplants, etc. Some offer percentage-based payouts for less severe conditions or allow for multiple payouts if you have more than one unrelated event. Mm-hmm. Guaranteed issue is often available, at least up to certain benefit amounts, meaning no health questions during enrollment. Premiums are typically age-banded, based on your age when you buy it. We're seeing trends towards covering more conditions, even specialized plans just focused on cancer.
Who finds this most appealing?
It often appeals to people with a family history of certain conditions, or those with high deductible health plans who worry about a large upfront cost after a diagnosis. It provides funds beyond just medical bills.
Okay. And hospital indemnity insurance, that's the one paying cash for each day you're in the hospital. How do those plans vary?
That's the core idea. It provides a fixed daily benefit amount, say $100 or $200 per day while you're confined in a hospital. Some plans pay a larger lump sum for the admission itself, regardless of length of stay.
To help with that initial hit.
Exactly. You'll see variations in the daily benefit amount, the maximum number of days the plan will pay for per confinement or per year, and whether it covers different types of confinement, like intensive care, differently. Some also add extra schedule benefits for things like ER visits, ambulance rides, diagnostic tests, or surgeries, even if you aren't admitted overnight.
Got it. And then we shift into some more specialized healthcare coverages, dental and vision. It seems like employees consistently say they really value these.
Oh, absolutely. They consistently rank super high in employee surveys. They're tangible. People use them frequently.
Right.
Dental insurance typically follows a structure like 100% coverage for preventive care, cleanings, x-rays, maybe 70-80% for basic procedures, fillings, and around 50% for major work, crowns, bridges, usually up to an annual dollar maximum. You'll see different network approaches to PPO or DHMO.
And trends in dental.
We're seeing more coverage for adult orthodontics, expanded coverage for implants, sometimes programs that reward you for getting preventive care.
Okay, and vision, pretty straightforward.
Generally, yes. Vision insurance usually covers a routine eye exam, often annually, and provides fixed dollar allowances towards frames and lenses, or covers contact lenses up to a certain amount. It's very network-driven.
What's new there?
Trends include adding coverage specifically for digital eye strain, enhanced lens options like progressives or anti-reflective coatings, sometimes discounts or benefits for LASIK surgery, maybe coverage for blue light filtering. They're highly requested, relatively low cost, and offer high perceived value.
Okay, switching gears a bit. Group legal plans and identity theft protection. These aren't traditional insurance, are they? What do they offer?
Right. These fall more into that lifestyle or financial wellness category, addressing specific modern needs. Group legal plans give you access to legal services, usually through a network of attorneys, for a range of common legal issues.
Like what kind of issues?
Often things like preparing wills or trusts, handling real estate closings, dealing with traffic tickets, basic family law document preparation, consumer protection issues. Sometimes ID theft assistance is bundled in. Usually, covered services are included for a monthly premium, and you get reduced fees for services not fully covered.
So access to affordable legal help.
Exactly. Mostly an employee-paid benefit. Identity theft protection services are also popular. They monitor your credit files, social security number usage, other personal info for signs of fraud.
And help if something happens.
Yes, they typically provide alerts, access to credit reports, and crucially, restoration assistance experts to help you fix the damage if your identity is stolen. Often include some insurance to cover expenses related to recovery. These are often employee paid too, providing peace of mind.
Okay. And pet insurance, you mentioned it earlier, it feels like it exploded onto the scene. What does that typically cover?
It really has gained traction, reflecting how many of us view pets as family members. Most policies cover veterinary bills for accidents and illnesses.
Unexpected vet visits.
Exactly. You can often add optional wellness riders for routine stuff like vaccinations and checkups. The reimbursement models vary. Some pay a percentage of the bill after a deductible. Others use a benefit schedule.
Exclusions.
Yeah, pre-existing conditions are usually excluded, sometimes breed-specific conditions. But coverage is getting broader things, like alternative therapies, chronic condition management, even hereditary conditions might be covered now.
Yeah.
Telemedicine for pets is also becoming a feature. Multi-pet discounts are common too.
Makes sense for multi-pet households.
Definitely.
And then we're seeing some really innovative benefits pop up, like student loan repayment programs and emergency savings help. How do those work? Are employers actually paying off loans?
These are newer but growing, especially student loan help. It works in different ways. Some employers make direct contributions towards an employee's student loan payments, maybe $50 or $100 a month.
Wow, direct help.
Yeah. Others might offer a 401k match based on the employee making student loan payments, sort of rewarding them for tackling debt. There are also educational resources and partnerships for refinancing. It's a hot area, addressing a major financial stressor.
And emergency savings.
These programs aim to help employees build that crucial cushion for unexpected expenses. Usually involve setting up an easy, automated payroll deduction into a separate savings account, maybe outside the regular 401k. The goal is just to make saving for emergencies frictionless.
Removing the barrier to just getting started.
Exactly. Relatively low cost for employers to facilitate, though engagement can sometimes be a challenge.
But we've also seen things like discount programs, wellness programs, EAPs offered as voluntary options too. It's a really broad category.
It is. These alternative, often non-insurance benefits provide value in different ways. Discount programs offer savings on travel, electronics, theme parks, all sorts of things. Wellness programs incentivize healthy habits, maybe gym memberships or fitness tracking.
EAPs, employee assistance programs.
Right. They offer confidential counseling, referrals, and resources for personal or work-related issues, stress, financial worries, family problems. Sometimes you see limited legal document prep services or financial counseling offered voluntarily, too. It really highlights how employers are using this voluntary chassis to offer a huge array of supports tailored to different needs.
Okay. So you decide you want one of these benefits. You go to enroll. How does the insurance company decide if they'll cover you and at what price? Let's talk underwriting.
Right. Underwriting is that risk assessment process. A huge feature in voluntary benefits is guaranteed issue, or GI.
Guaranteed issue meaning you get approved automatically.
Essentially, yes. Up to a certain coverage amount, typically during specific enrollment periods, like when you're newly hired or during the annual open enrollment, no health questions asked.
That seems really appealing. Any catch?
Well, there might be some initial eligibility rules, like having to be actively at work. Plans might have limitations on pre-existing conditions for a period, say, the first 6 or 12 months, and the premium rates might be slightly higher overall to account for accepting everyone within the limits.
Trends in GI.
We're seeing carriers increasing the maximum amounts offered under GI, sometimes relaxing participation requirements for larger groups to qualify for higher GI levels.
Okay. What if you want more coverage than the guaranteed issue amount allows?
Then you often move into simplified issue, or SI.
Simplified, meaning fewer questions than full underwriting.
Exactly. It's a middle ground. You'll likely need to answer a short set of health-related questions, maybe 3 to 10 questions, depending on the product and amount.
Things like, have you been treated for cancer in the last 5 years?
Precisely. Based on your answers, they decide eligibility. It's often done electronically now, very streamlined. Insurers are using algorithms, sometimes alternative data sources, to make this faster. Some platforms offer automated approvals almost instantly if you answer favorably.
So still easier than a full medical exam.
Much easier. It's an important way to offer higher coverage levels without the hassle of full underwriting.
And traditional underwriting, the full health questionnaire, maybe a nurse visit, blood test, is that common in voluntary benefits?
It's becoming less common, especially for the typical amounts offered. But it's still used, particularly for very high amounts of life or disability insurance, or sometimes for specific products like long-term care insurance if offered voluntarily.
So more intensive.
Yes. More comprehensive health questions, potentially a paramedical exam, maybe reviewing medical records. While it's more involved for you, it allows insurers to accurately price the risk and offer those much higher benefit levels. But even here, we're seeing modernization integrating electronic health records, accelerated pathways for healthier applicants.
You mentioned guaranteed issue is often tied to specific enrollment periods. Can you elaborate on that? Continuous versus conditional.
Right. That's an important distinction. Continuous guaranteed issue, where GI is available anytime, is pretty rare in the voluntary space. Why? Adverse selection.
People waiting until they needed to sign up.
Exactly. So conditional guaranteed issue is far more common. This means the GI offer is limited to specific events or periods, typically that initial new hire window or the annual open enrollment, maybe a qualifying life event like getting married.
So you need to act during those windows.
Generally, yes, if you want the easiest path to coverage. There might also be different participation requirements for the group to maintain certain GI levels year after year. Understanding these conditions is really crucial for both you and your employer's strategy.
Okay, let's talk pricing. How do they actually figure out the premium rates for these benefits? You mentioned age bands.
Yeah, pricing methodologies vary. Age-banded structures are very common, especially for life, disability, and critical illness. Rates are set for age categories, maybe 5-year bands, 10-year bands.
So everyone aged 40-49 pays the same rate?
Typically, yes. How your age is determined can vary, too. Is it your age when you first buy issue age? Or does it go up as you move into new bands, attained age? That affects long-term cost.
What about composite rate?
Composite rating is another approach, often seen in smaller groups or for certain benefits like dental or vision. A single rate might apply to all employees, or maybe one rate for employees, another for spouses, another for children.
So younger people might subsidize older people?
Essentially, yes. Mm. There's significant cross-subsidization. It simplifies administration, which is attractive, but it carries more risk of adverse selection if healthier, younger people opt out because the rate feels high for them.
Are rates ever different based on gender?
It's less common now, particularly for health-related benefits, due to regulations like the ACA and state rules often mandating unisex rates. You still see gender-distinct rates more often in life insurance in many places, though. Understanding these methods helps employers align the pricing with their goals, balancing risk accuracy versus administrative simplicity or philosophical considerations.
So we have the coverage. We know roughly how it's priced. What actually triggers a payout? And what are common reasons a claim might not be paid the exclusions?
Benefit triggers are key. This is the specific event defined in the policy that has to happen for you to get paid. For disability income, the trigger variations are significant.
Like own occupation versus any occupation.
Exactly. Own occ means you get benefits if you can't do your specific job. Any occ means you have to be unable to do any job you're reasonably suited for. How long the own occ definition lasts is a major factor. There are also presumptive disability provisions automatically considered disabled if you lose sight or limbs, for instance.
Critical illness triggers.
They're very condition specific. The policy will list the covered conditions and the exact diagnostic criteria or severity thresholds that must be met. A mild heart attack might not trigger the same benefit as a severe one, for example.
Hospital indemnity.
Triggers usually relate to the length of confinement, maybe the type of care received. ICU versus regular
rickets. Exclusions, things that prevent a payout.
Common exclusions across many voluntary benefits include pre-existing conditions, often for a limited duration after you enroll, say 6 or 12 months. Losses due to war or military service are often excluded, so sometimes with exceptions for terrorism. Intentionally self-inflicted injuries. Cosmetic procedures usually aren't covered. And participating in illegal activities. Reading the fine print on triggers and exclusions is vital.
Okay, so you have this coverage while you're employed. What happens if you leave your job? Do you just lose the benefit? You mentioned portability earlier.
Yeah, this is a really important value add. Portability allows you to continue your existing group coverage after you leave your employer without having to convert it to a different type of policy.
So you keep the same plan?
Generally, yes. You keep the coverage, usually at the same group rates or perhaps slightly adjusted rates, and you start paying the premiums directly to the insurance carrier instead of through payroll deduction.
Are there limits?
Sometimes the amount of coverage you can port might be limited, but the ability to keep the plan intact is the main benefit. It requires the carrier to have systems for direct billing. It's a crucial feature that enhances the long-term value.
What if portability isn't an option, or you don't want to port? Is there another way?
Then you might have conversion privileges. This allows you to transition your group coverage into an individual policy issued by the same insurer, usually without having to provide evidence of insurability, meaning no new health questions.
So you can still get coverage even if your health has changed.
Exactly. That's the safety net aspect. However, conversion usually involves moving to a different type of individual policy form, and the premiums are almost always significantly higher than the group rates or portability rates. The coverage might also differ somewhat. There are usually strict time frames to elect conversion, like within 31 days of leaving the job.
So portability is usually better if available, but conversion is a backstop.
That's a good summary. Understanding both is key to seeing the full value proposition.
How do these voluntary plans interact with other benefits you might have, like Social Security disability or workers' comp? Is there coordination?
Yes, coordination of benefits is definitely something to be aware of. For long-term disability, for instance, many policies include an offset for Social Security Disability Insurance, SSDI benefits.
Meaning your benefit gets reduced?
Potentially, yes. If you're approved for SSDI, your LTD benefit from the insurance company might be reduced by some or all the SSDI amount. How this offset works, full, partial, different formulas, impacts the plan's cost and how much you actually receive.
What about workers' comp?
There are usually rules to prevent double dipping for the same disability if it's work-related. How exactly they coordinate can vary, and Medicare coordination becomes really important for people approaching retirement or working past 65. Understanding these interactions prevents surprises and helps you see the net benefit you'd receive.
Let's talk taxes. We pay premiums, maybe receive benefits. How does the IRS view all this?
Tax implications have a big economic impact. Let's break it down. Premium tax treatment. If your employer pays the premium for something like disability insurance, that premium cost is generally deductible for the employer, but might be considered taxable income to you.
Okay.
If you pay the premium with after-tax dollars, which is common for voluntary benefits.
Then what about the benefits?
Then generally, if you receive benefits from that policy, like supplemental health payments or disability payments, those benefits are usually received income tax free.
Ah, that is a significant advantage.
It really is. Life insurance, death benefits paid to beneficiaries are also generally income tax free. There are nuances, of course, especially around disability taxation, depending on pre-tax versus post-tax premiums and specific rules for HSA compatibility. Supplemental health plans need careful design to avoid providing first-dollar coverage that could disqualify you from contributing to an HSA. Tax treatment definitely affects the net value.
Okay, so you've enrolled, you understand the plan. Now, if you actually need to use it, file a claim, what does that process typically involve? Is it a hassle?
Claims administration is critical. It's where the insurer delivers on the promise. The experience can vary a lot. Documentation requirements differ. Some carriers have really streamlined online or mobile claim filing. Others might still rely more on paper forms and require extensive records.
Making it easy or hard for the claimant.
Exactly. The adjudication process, how they review and decide on the claim, can also differ. Is it centralized, automated? What's the appeals process like if a claim is denied?
What about support during the claim?
That's huge for the employee experience. Does the insurer provide dedicated case managers? Is communication proactive or reactive? How clearly do they explain decisions? Can you reach them easily through multiple channels? All this significantly impacts how you feel during a potentially stressful time.
And if you have multiple voluntary benefits from the same employer?
Ideally, there's some integration, maybe a common intake process, coordinated documentation request, integrated claim system so you don't have to tell your story multiple times. That makes for a much better experience.
It really sounds like there's so much more to consider than just the benefit name and the price tag. The whole structure underneath really dictates the value.
Absolutely. You hit the nail on the head. Beyond the flashy product categories and the headline benefit amounts, it's these structural elements, underwriting, pricing, triggers, exclusions, portability, conversion coordination, tax treatment, and the claims process that truly determine the actual value delivered to you and the long-term sustainability of the program.
Okay, shifting gears again slightly. Employers offer these benefits, but how do they actually get employees, get you to understand them and sign up? What are the enrollment strategies?
Effective enrollment is crucial. If people don't sign up, the benefit isn't doing anyone any good. One key distinction is active versus passive enrollment.
Active means you have to choose. Passive means you get defaulted in.
Basically, yes. Active enrollment requires you to make explicit choices, yes or no, for each benefit. Passive enrollment might default you into certain coverages unless you actively opt out, or default you out unless you opt in. For voluntary benefits, active enrollment is generally preferred and more common, ensuring people consciously choose and understand what they're buying.
And is enrollment done separately or alongside your main health insurance choices?
Both happen. Separate enrollment periods for voluntary benefits can allow more focused communication. But the trend, especially for mid-size and larger employers with good tech platforms, is towards integrated enrollment, handling core and voluntary benefits all in one go during the main open enrollment window.
Makes sense for efficiency.
Yeah, simplifies the process for employees too. One-stop shopping.
How have the platforms themselves changed? You mentioned moving beyond paper.
Oh, dramatically. We went from paper forms, lots of admin, often lower participation, limited decision support.
Yeah, confusing packets.
Right. To digital platforms, web portals, mobile apps. Much more convenient, generally higher participation, though access can still be a challenge for some workers. Now, the leading edge is multi-channel.
Multi-channel.
Combining digital tools with other support, maybe call centers, access to benefits counselors, virtual or in-person, educational webinars. Offers flexibility, consistency, usually yields the highest participation, but it's more complex to integrate well. The trend is definitely digital and multi-channel.
What about when enrollment happens just once a year?
Different strategies exist. Aligning with the annual core benefits enrollment is common for simplicity. Some employers might hold off-cycle enrollment specifically for voluntary benefits, perhaps mid-year. Ongoing enrollment options might exist for certain benefits. Mm-hmm. And integrating voluntary enrollment smoothly into the new higher onboarding process is critical. Each timing strategy has pros and cons regarding communication focus and administrative effort.
And communication, how do employers get the word out effectively?
Communication strategy is key. Goals are typically awareness, what's offered, education, how does it work, why might I need it, and driving enrollment action. Channels are diverse. Print materials, emails, internal websites, webinars, virtual or in-person meetings, even empowering managers to talk about benefits. The most effective strategies usually blend education with clear calls to action.
Is it getting more personalized?
Definitely. Personalization and targeting are huge trends. Segmenting communications based on demographics or job roles, providing guidance tailored to different life stages, new parent, nearing retirement, etc. Using interactive calculators for needs assessment. Some platforms even use predictive analytics to suggest benefits you might find most relevant based on your profile, though ethical considerations are important there. The goal is to increase relevance and help you make more informed decisions.
Implementing a new voluntary benefits program sounds like a big undertaking.
It is. A typical implementation timeline, from initial strategy and design through carrier selection, pre-enrollment prep, the enrollment event itself, and post-enrollment processing, can easily span 12 to 18 months for a significant program.
Wow.
Key success factors include strong leadership support, clear roles and accountability, realistic timelines, good change management, and systems to measure results. And the work doesn't stop. After enrollment, ongoing administration requires careful attention to eligibility changes, premium processing, coverage updates, claim support, and compliance. It's a continuous cycle.
This brings up an interesting point with employers facilitating these choices and brokers often involved. Are there ethical considerations we need to think about?
Absolutely. Ethics are hugely important in voluntary benefits. It's this intersection of business goals, employee welfare, and professional responsibility. The voluntary nature itself creates distinct ethical considerations. Employees are placing trust in their employer and the advisors involved.
Is there a formal fiduciary duty, like with retirement plans?
It's a bit fuzzier for most voluntary benefits, unless they fall under ERISA, which many are designed not to. However, there's arguably an ethical duty for employers to offer appropriate, fairly priced, and well-administered benefits. Brokers and consultants also have ethical responsibilities regarding transparency about their relationships and how they're compensated.
What about the actual selling or recommendation process?
Needs-based selling is the ethical imperative here. Understanding an employee's actual situation, their income protection needs, health cost exposure, financial goals before recommending specific products, avoiding just pushing whatever product pays the highest commission.
How do you ensure that happens?
Good practice involves comprehensive needs assessment tools, considering all available options, including doing nothing, avoiding assumptions based on demographics alone, and documenting the rationale for recommendations.
Transparency seems key, too, about the products themselves.
Crucial. Clear, accessible information about how products work, what they cost, what triggers benefits, and importantly, what the limitations and exclusions are. Plain language, maybe real-life examples, individualized rate disclosure, some context on competitiveness, clear disclosure of commissions or fees, managing expectations about long-term pricing. These are all part of ethical transparency.
What about the enrollment process itself? Any ethical pitfalls there?
Yes. Enrollers need proper training on the products and ethical conduct. Using standardized approved scripts can help. Recording enrollment sessions provides accountability, monitoring enrollment patterns for anomalies, and robust data protection is paramount. High-pressure sales tactics or misleading information are obvious ethical breaches. Even enrollment incentives need careful design to avoid unduly influencing choices.
And data privacy, especially with personalization.
That's a huge ethical area now. How is employee data collected, stored, used, shared? Ethical standards are needed for marketing personalization, getting consent, respecting preferences, if using predictive modeling, ensuring fairness and transparency, being clear about boundaries if integrating with social media data, avoiding unfair discrimination through segmentation. Special care is needed for potentially vulnerable populations who might have lower financial literacy or specific health concerns.
Suitability is another term I hear. Making sure the benefit fits.
Exactly. Ensuring the recommended benefits align with an individual employee's actual needs and their financial circumstances. The last thing you want is for a voluntary benefit premium to create additional financial vulnerability for an employee.
What about the economics behind it? Are these plans always a good deal?
That's an ethical dimension, too. Looking at things like premium to benefit ratios or loss ratios, how much premium comes in versus how much is paid out in claims. Transparency about the overall economic arrangements, including employer financial interests versus employee welfare, is important.
Can you give an example of an ethical dilemma?
Sure. Maybe an employer is considering replacing an existing popular plan with a new one that has lower premiums but also significantly reduced benefits or tighter triggers. Balancing cost savings with reduced employee protection is a classic ethical tension. Or deciding whether to use pre-enrollment health questions that might screen some people out versus offering guaranteed issue at a higher overall premium.
Are there frameworks or guidance for navigating this?
Yes. Industry associations, financial planning organizations often have codes of ethics. Key principles usually involve objective product evaluation, considering alternative compensation models for advisors that reduce conflicts of interest, and having strong governance structures in place at the employer level.
Behavioral economics nudging people towards choices. How does that intersect with ethics?
It's being used more in benefits enrollment. Things like how options are bundled, the order they're presented, anchoring, using loss-framed communication, don't miss out, staged enrollment processes, highlighting social norms, most employees choose. The ethical use of these techniques means ensuring they genuinely help employees make better choices aligned with their interests, not just boosting participation numbers or profits.
And measuring outcomes, does that have an ethical angle?
I think so. Ethically, programs should demonstrate they're delivering actual value to employees. That means looking beyond just participation rates to the financial impact when claims occur, employee satisfaction and understanding, benchmarking against alternatives. Are the benefits truly providing the promised security?
So the future of ethics here, especially with more personalization.
It requires even stronger ethical frameworks. How do we use data responsibly? How do we design products fairly? How do we communicate transparently and ensure genuine understanding in an increasingly complex landscape? These are ongoing ethical challenges.
Okay, let's shift to the legal side. You mentioned regulations earlier. It sounds like a complex web.
It really is. A complex web of federal and state requirements impacting pretty much everything. Design, distribution, implementation, administration.
What's ERISA? Does that apply?
ERISA, the Employee Retirement Income Security Act, is a major federal law. But it primarily governs employer-sponsored plans like pensions and group health insurance. Many voluntary benefit programs are intentionally structured to fall outside ERISA by meeting certain safe harbor criteria.
Yes, safe harbor.
Yes. Generally, to avoid ERISA, the program must be fully employee paid, No employer contributions. Participation must be completely voluntary. The employer can't endorse the program beyond limited administrative functions like payroll deduction. And the employer can't receive compensation beyond reasonable admin fees.
So if the employer contributes or strongly endorses it,
then it likely becomes an ERISA plan, triggering a whole host of compliance requirements, plan documents, summary plan descriptions, SPDs, fiduciary responsibilities, reporting. It's a strategic choice for employers whether to structure voluntary plans as ERISA or non-ERISA.
What about state regulations?
State insurance regulations are huge. They regulate the insurance products themselves and the activities of insurance producers, agents, brokers. States approve policy forms, set standards for readability, sometimes mandate specific benefits or coverages within certain types of policies.
And licensing.
Yes. States require producers to be licensed, often needing non-resident licenses in states where they enroll employees. There are rules around compensation disclosure, continuing education requirements. States also set market conduct standards, rules about advertising, preventing unfair claim practices, ensuring data privacy and security, and there's significant variation from state to state, which adds complexity.
Any other major federal laws involved besides potentially ERISA?
Oh, yes. The Affordable Care Act, ACA, has implications, like how benefits coordinate with minimum essential coverage, though the individual mandate penalty is gone and the Cadillac tax was repealed. EPA applies to the privacy and security of health information if health-related benefits are involved. The ADA affects accessibility for employees with disabilities. ADA relates to age discrimination. Tax laws, as we discussed, are crucial. Even FMLA interaction might be relevant for disability plans.
It sounds like ongoing compliance is a major task.
It is. Things like providing annual notices, claims procedure notifications, record keeping, potential reporting requirements. It requires constant vigilance.
What about the other players, TPAs, enrollment firms? Are they regulated too?
Yes. TPAs often need state licenses and have specific requirements outlined in their service agreements with employers, including compliance with ERISA or state insurance laws as applicable.
Cool.
Enrollment firms and their personnel usually fall under state producer licensing rules, including training and compensation disclosure.
If a plan is under ERISA, what are those fiduciary responsibilities?
Fiduciaries, often the employer, have duties of prudence and loyalty. This includes carefully selecting and monitoring the insurance carriers and other service providers, ensuring fees are reasonable, avoiding prohibited transactions, and communicating effectively with participants.
Any recent legal or regulatory shifts we should know about?
There's been movement towards expanded electronic disclosure options, allowing more notices to be delivered online under certain conditions. Ongoing clarification from the Department of Labor about fiduciary responsibilities, especially around the selection and monitoring process, and the expansion of state-level privacy laws is impacting data handling across the board.
So compliance isn't just red tape, it's really foundational.
Absolutely. It's the foundation for a sustainable and trustworthy voluntary benefits program.
Looking ahead now, what are some of the emerging trends? Where is the future of voluntary benefits heading?
Innovation is constant. On the product side, we're seeing more sophisticated student loan repayment assistance programs, exploring different tax treatments and contribution strategies. Paid family leave is mandated in more states, so we're seeing voluntary supplements emerge to enhance those benefits.
Filling the gaps again?
Exactly. More integration with specialized EAPs, maybe focusing on caregiver support. Gamification is being used to boost engagement with wellness or financial tools. Personalized financial guidance platforms are moving beyond just retirement planning.
Like on-demand financial counseling.
Yes, or AI-driven advice.
Yeah.
Mental health support is huge, expanding beyond traditional EAPs to include digital therapeutic apps, specialized networks, family-building benefits, fertility, adoption, surrogacy support are gaining traction. Pet insurance continues to evolve with broader coverage. Identity protection is expanding to cover kids, medical ID theft, social media monitoring.
What about the technology enabling all this?
Tech advancement is key. Decision support tools are getting smarter, using AI for more personalized recommendations. Video is being integrated more into enrollment platforms for explanation and connection. Behavioral science principles are being baked into platform design to nudge better decisions.
And data analytics, going beyond just participation numbers.
Much further. Moving towards comprehensive insights, using predictive modeling to anticipate needs, creating closed-loop measurement to see if benefits actually mitigated financial harm after an event, using natural language processing on employee feedback, integrating outcomes data from claims.
Administration getting smoother, too.
That's the goal. More API connectivity between systems for real-time data flow. single-source implementation platforms, mobile-first administration tools for employees and HR.
How are changing demographics shaping the future?
The workforce is only getting more diverse. We have expanding generational diversity. Gen Z's expectations are different from millennials, who are different from Gen X and their sandwich generation pressures, while boomers may work longer. Evolving family structures continue to demand flexibility. Cultural diversity requires more nuanced communication and product design that respects different attitudes towards risk and financial responsibility.
And broader workforce priorities, what's changing there?
We're seeing shifts post-pandemic, heightened focus on health security, increased awareness of financial fragility, driving demand for emergency savings, income protection, and better financial education. Workplace flexibility and remote work demand digital-first implementation and asynchronous communication strategies. For global companies, there's interest in standardizing benefits where possible while adapting to diverse international systems.
Personalization seems like the overarching theme.
It really is. Moving towards hyper-personalization. Targeting communications and recommendations to micro moments in an employee's life using dynamic recommendation engines, allowing employees more configurable coverage design options, adapting interfaces based on behavioral responses,
and integrating voluntary benefits with wider well-being efforts.
Absolutely. Breaking down the silos between physical health, mental health, and financial wellness programs, voluntary benefits are increasingly seen as key tools within that integrated well-being strategy.
So continuous evolution is the name of the game.
No question. It requires employers and advisors to stay forward-looking, anticipating needs, and aligning benefit strategies with these emerging expectations.
Can you share some examples of how this plays out in the real world? Maybe successful implementations in different industries?
Sure. Take a healthcare organization. They might face challenges with clinical staff burnout. A successful voluntary strategy could involve segmenting their approach.
How so?
Targeting benefits like identity theft protection, high-stress data exposure risk, robust legal plans, complex contracts, life planning, and enhanced caregiver support, common pressure point, specifically towards clinical staff. Using multi-channel enrollment to accommodate erratic shift schedules. Communicating strategically through existing channels like nursing unit meetings.
And the results.
You might see exceptional participation in those targeted benefits, sustainable costs due to focused enrollment, and data showing meaningful utilization, like legal plan use for estate planning or ID theft alerts being resolved.
What about a different setting like manufacturing?
There, the focus might be more on core financial protection. A successful approach could emphasize accident insurance, critical illness, and supplemental life insurance. Communication might need to be very simple, concrete, using relatable examples of how benefits help pay bills if someone gets hurt off the job.
Tailoring the message.
Exactly. Implementation might need to align with shift schedules, maybe using on-site enrollers or kiosks during breaks. Getting plant managers engaged to champion the benefits could be key.
Success metrics there.
Strong adoption of those core protection benefits across different shifts and demographics. Measurable improvements in financial wellness surveys. Positive employee testimonials about how a benefit helped them through a tough time. Maybe even data suggesting improved retention among participants.
And maybe a tech company, different culture, different needs.
Right. A tech company might prioritize flexibility and choice, aligning with a culture of autonomy. The strategy could involve offering a wider array of niche benefits, pet insurance, student loan help, enhanced mental health options.
Leveraging tech for enrollment?
Absolutely. A seamless digital enrollment experience. Maybe integrating voluntary options directly into their existing HR tech stack. Personalized recommendations using sophisticated choice architecture.
Outcome.
High overall participation driven by choice and relevance. Enhanced perception of the benefits package as competitive and modern. Positive impact on talent attraction and retention metrics.
It's helpful to see how context matters so much. How do companies measure the actual return on these programs, the ROI?
Measuring ROI for voluntary benefits can be tricky, but it's becoming more sophisticated. Let's imagine a large national retailer. They might implement a comprehensive measurement framework.
What would that include?
Tracking participation rates, obviously, but also looking at the economic impact, analyzing claims data, in aggregate, protecting privacy, to see how benefits offset out-of-pocket costs for employees. Evaluating integration, how well do voluntary benefits fill gaps in core plans? Assessing retention impact, do employees who participate in voluntary benefits stay longer? Maybe even exploring correlations with productivity data, though that's harder. And crucially, gathering employee feedback through surveys and focus groups.
So combining quantitative and qualitative data.
Exactly. This retailer might find, for instance, that their critical illness plan paid out significant benefits that helped employees avoid debt after a major diagnosis. They might identify opportunities to better integrate it with their high-deductible health plan communication. And they might calculate a quantifiable ROI based purely on the reduced turnover costs associated with retaining participating employees.
What about when implementations don't go well? What are common challenges or lessons learned?
Things definitely go wrong sometimes. A common failure point is communication coordination. Imagine a professional services firm rolling out several new voluntary benefits with different carriers and enrollment teams.
Sounds messy.
It can be. If communication isn't centrally coordinated, employees get confusing, maybe conflicting messages. They don't understand the value proposition. Enrollment deadlines are unclear. Participation tanks. The recovery often involves hitting pause, developing a unified communication plan, retraining enrollers, and doing proactive outreach.
Technology glitches must happen too.
Oh, yeah. A financial services company might invest in a new integrated benefits platform, but the voluntary benefit module has bugs. Maybe the integration with payroll fails, or the mobile user experience is terrible. Enrollment gets derailed.
Lessons there.
Recognizing the limitations of pre-launch testing. Always having robust backup enrollment methods. Prioritizing user experience from the employee's perspective. Ensuring adequate technical support is ready to scale during peak enrollment.
You've emphasized tailoring to the workforce. Can you give examples of adapting approaches for specific demographics, say, a multi-generational workforce?
Good example.
Yeah.
A company with lots of boomers, Gen X, millennials, and Gen Z might adopt a strategy allowing customization of protection intensity. Younger workers might prioritize affordability and basic coverage, while older workers might want higher benefit amounts, maybe adding long-term care riders.
And communication.
Multi-channel communication becomes essential. Digital for younger gens, perhaps print and meetings for older ones. Providing specific support and guidance around life stage transitions, buying a home, having kids, planning for retirement where different voluntary benefits become relevant. Success looks like demographically balanced participation across the different benefits and positive feedback on that life stage support.
What about engaging, say, a predominantly blue-collar workforce, maybe in transportation or construction?
Engagement strategies might need to be different there. Emphasis on fundamental explanations, less jargon, more focus on what does this do for me and my family? Using very concrete value illustrations, this pays $6 if you break your leg off the job.
Meeting them where they are.
Exactly. Engagement might need to adapt to schedules, toolbox talks, break room sessions, mobile enrollment options. Utilizing trusted messengers, maybe union reps or respected supervisors, to explain the value. Success is strong participation in the benefits most relevant to their risks, like accident, disability, and hearing positive testimonials about financial relief provided.
What about integrating voluntary benefits into a broader financial wellness platform?
We see large employers doing this effectively, recognizing that vulnerability isn't just about insurance gaps, but includes debt, savings, retirement readiness. They might create a unified platform bringing together voluntary benefits, the 401k, emergency savings tools, debt management resources.
A holistic view.
Yes. Maybe using a prioritized recommendation engine based on a financial wellness assessment, ensuring a seamless user experience across all these components. Success is measured by exceptional engagement metrics across the platform, measurable improvements in employee financial resilience scores, positive feedback on navigating major life events using the platform's resources, and ideally, retention impact.
One last example. Any unique models linking benefits to, say, community impact?
That's an interesting one. Imagine a regional bank wanting to deepen community ties. They might create a model where the bank makes a corporate donation to a local charity for every employee who enrolls in a specific protection-focused voluntary benefit, like critical illness.
Tying enrollment to giving back.
Right. Maybe offer related employee volunteer opportunities. Communicate the program, emphasizing the dual benefit, personal protection, and community support, aligning with the bank's mission. Success could be exceptional participation driven by that added incentive, strong employee engagement in the linked volunteer activities, and an enhanced sense of connection between employees, the bank, and the community.
These real-world applications really show how much adaptation and strategy are involved. It's not just picking products off a shelf.
Not at all. Successful implementation is a learning laboratory. It requires contextual adaptation to the specific industry and workforce, strategic communication, smart technology enablement, continuous evaluation and refinement, and favoring integration over keeping benefits in silos. Those are the key themes we see again and again.
This has been incredibly comprehensive. So, wrapping up, the key takeaway seems to be that voluntary benefits offer a really powerful way for you to personalize your overall compensation and protection package.
Absolutely. It's about choice and tailoring things to your specific situation.
And understanding this wide array of options, life, disability, supplemental health, legal, pet, all the others, and the nuances of how they actually work, that's crucial for making informed decisions, decisions that fit your needs, your circumstances.
Couldn't agree more. The details matter. The triggers, exclusions, portabilities.
We've explored the evolution, how we got here, the different types available today, and those key considerations for enrollment and structure.
Hopefully providing a solid foundation.
So the encouragement for you, the listener, is to think about your own financial vulnerabilities, your family's needs. What areas of protection feel most important to you right now?
It's a personal assessment.
This deep dive should hopefully empower you to ask the right questions, whether it's during open enrollment or talking to your HR department or benefits administrator.
Don't hesitate to ask those questions.
Remember, these benefits are really a partnership between your employer, who facilitates access, and you, who makes the choices. They're designed to provide you with valuable options.
Options you might not have otherwise.
So we really encourage you to further explore the voluntary benefits available to you and seriously consider taking advantage of those that can provide greater peace of mind and financial security.
It's worth the time to investigate.
As you reflect on all this, what stands out to you as maybe the most surprising or valuable aspect of voluntary benefits? And what questions do you still have? This is really just the beginning of understanding how these diverse options can work for you.